Good morning. I'd like to welcome you all to the study session for the Mesa City Council, Thursday, February 26, 2009. We'll begin with the first item on our agenda, which is to review the agenda items for the March 2nd City Council meeting. Okay. No, I had a lousy flight. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. On item 6B, the zoning case, this is for introduction. I note that the recommendation from Planning and Zoning was for denial. I don't mind keeping on consent for introduction, but I've been on record as opposing it. I will when we take action on it later next month. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
I guess I was on, you said page 6 right there.
Page 6, that's correct.
Is 8A on page 6?
No.
I'll wait.
Oh, they probably added all those new items, yeah. Which pushed it back. Okay, nothing else on page 6? Page 7? Now, Councilmember Higgins.
Item 8A, the annexation, pre-annexation development agreement. I would like, I'll talk to Mr. Wesley. In there, in all the specifications, it doesn't like highlight that says this area is in the night sky or dark sky area of the city and therefore will not follow the standard city guidelines for streets, street lights. Can that be in there?
Wait a second. It's not in the skylight area?
It is in the dark sky.
And therefore should follow the...
Yes. Okay. And not follow the standard city.
Are you asking if that should be a condition of annexation?
No, it is, but... It's not a condition of annexation. It's already in that area. I just want to make sure it's clear, or is it clear? By default of the address, it's clear.
Yeah, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, that's correct. The area is clearly defined in the ordinance, okay. And it's within that area so that those provisions will apply regardless.
Awesome.
So it is clearly illuminated in the section.
Yes.
Of this
It's clearly illuminated.
Subtly illuminated.
With low light, but it's clear.
And it's different than the desert uplands guideline.
It's more specific than the standard desert uplands.
Great, thank you.
If I could just add one thing to that, the neighbors
have
been. You'd
like to shed some light on this issue.
Very small amount.
We could go on and on.
We have had conversations with the neighbors in that area regarding the lighting standards, and when the project actually comes through development, which is not now, we can actually look at unique lighting standards for that area. So there will be a lot of discussion with the neighbors and the developers once it comes through. Okay.
Yes, this was. Okay. Thank you. Anything else on page 7? Okay. Thank you. We'll go on to item number 2, which is the hearer presentation discussion and provide direction on City Council strategic initiatives.
Good morning, Your Honor, members of the council.
Go right ahead.
I'm Natalie Lewis. I'm assistant to the city manager. And it's hard to believe that it's been almost 6 months ago that this then new city council came together over at the Dobson Ranch Golf Course and worked very hard at talking about, you know, your vision and dreams for Mesa, kind of in a less informal or in an informal atmosphere. Talked about values and attributes of high-performing councils, governing bodies, your individual leadership styles, your team profile, and then most importantly, talking about what you saw as the most important strategic initiatives that the organization needs to be focusing on, as well as some high priorities, high objective priorities. You have copies of these in the materials that you got for the meeting today, but I will be putting these up on the Elmo for the audience here today and also for those at home. Right after the workshop, the new economy became a reality for us, and we had to put a lot of focus and energy there. And the council responded by creating new efficient service models, delivery models, reorganizing, restructuring, scaling back on some services that we needed to just to provide a real strong financial foundation for our future. Today, we're in the midst of planning for the 2009 and 2010 budget process and bringing forward recommendations for your consideration. And so the purpose of today's study session is it felt like the right time to bring back these strategic initiatives for you to just revisit them, refamiliarize yourself with them, provide any clarifying comments for us, the organization, as we move forward in our budget planning and preparation, and also to look at the high priority objectives, and especially within the context of this new economy, to see if there's any changes that the council wanted us to make. And so, Mayor, if it's okay with you, what I'll do is just put each of the strategic initiatives up on the Elmo, and then just open it up for the City Council to provide any clarifying comments and feedback. I've got some examples of existing services and programs. I'm prepared to talk about a few of them, not all encompassing, but to provide some examples of what the organization is already doing to respond to these strategic initiatives. But I can scale back on that, whatever is your pleasure.
Why don't we get going and we'll see how it goes.
Okay. The first one, the first strategic initiative, and you had five of them, related to economic development. Economic development that's innovative and business friendly, and that includes a variety of strategic tools, redevelopment of older and vacant areas, and a focus on downtown. Go through all of them?
Yes, go through all of them.
The second was community engagement, to build pride in our city and to encourage a wide range of civic leadership. This includes involvement of neighborhoods, nonprofit, and faith-based organizations, and direct communications with our citizens. Quality of life for citizens of Mesa. That includes safe and clean neighborhoods and parks, cultural and arts amenities, and excellent educational opportunities, all of which should be sustainable and environmentally responsible. Regional leadership that addresses challenges that require regional cooperation, such as transportation and water. Regional leadership that is innovative, that focuses on sustainability, and that includes partnerships with educational institutions. And your fifth strategic initiative, financial stability, that provides proactive leadership and considers all financial factors, such as revenues, expenditures, taxes, budgeting, and efficiency. Those are the five strategic initiatives.
I think the one thing that strikes me is you mentioned something which we really don't, consciously consider, but as I'm looking through those initiatives, I'm wondering what would have changed in our initiatives had we done them 2 or 3 months later. And I'm not sure that many things had changed, but I think the initiatives are still there, but you're right in the fact that when we made these, we had an inkling that there were challenges and struggles financially. We had not fallen off the edge yet. And so what I was thinking as we went through this is, how have we made our decisions based on the reality we live with now, which is one of serious financial challenge? And how have we made decisions related not only to the financial side, but to other issues that affect the city, such as in quality of life, when we talk about parks, cultural and arts amenities, things like that. You know, obviously the world's changed, and not so subtly since we went over these. The question is, how in this environment can we still work toward these initiatives while dealing with the financial realities that we have? And you know, maybe that's a matter of definition and of in many ways, I think it's caused us or allowed us, however you want to look at it, to focus in more on what things that are important. And I think we've actually done a better job than we might have. In other areas, it's obvious that we can't, at this time, maybe do as much or move as quickly as perhaps we imagined at the time we set these initiatives. But these initiatives, once again, are long-term visions, are long-term right. goals, are ways, are guidelines that we set up for ourselves to help us and direct us in the decisions we make. Mr. Brady has a comment.
Yes, Mayor and Council. Just what we've done, and I think your comments are right on, and here you have those, and I think we just wanted to review those with Council. You'll notice that Natalie's also provided, and this is just a very brief kind of snapshot. If you take she's taken each one of the strategic initiatives, and actually we have a very large volume of programs that we went back as a staff and said, okay, here are the identified strategic initiatives of the City Council. What are we already doing in that regard in some areas, just to kind of give an idea, because sometimes it helps look at that and decide or understand that. And so that's provided as attachment C. So you can see that where she's taken each one, a list of what, five or so different initiatives or programs, actually, that are taking place under each one of those quality of life. Just to give you a sense how we kind of interpreted those initiatives in the context of what we're doing today. So this would continue to be a guide for us, and I think we've tried as staff to use the strategic initiatives in the context of discussions we try to bring to Council. So really for today's purposes, we just wanted to review again with Council those strategic initiatives, confirm again that those are still important to the City Council. Notice that we have identified existing programs. These are just a snapshot. We have many more, obviously, that fall under each one of those. And then Natalie will talk a little bit later about what the current high priority objectives. And that's probably where we'll need to get a little more refinement of the direction from Council as we move forward, because I think there is where you're going to see maybe the opportunity to define kind of where are we headed under these initiatives as we move in closer into the budget discussions.
Okay.
So you want me to go ahead and move into the high priority objectives, or?
Let's go ahead, unless some other council member has a question or comment. Move ahead.
Okay. Okay. You had 9 of them. We went through a prioritizing and strategic planning process, and the top 9 were the ones that had the most council support as a team. And so those were the ones that we identified, or you identified, as your high priority objectives, and meaning that we wanted to have organizational focus and move towards some action planning within the next 2-year time period. The very first one was to reconvene the Financing the Future Committee and review its mission, implement a citizen review board for examining and supporting professional efforts for efficiencies throughout city departments in order to encourage community confidence in our efforts. The second had to do with the zoning ordinance rewrite with an emphasis on form-based code, with a transportation overlay district for light rail. Codes should emphasize infill development, redevelopment, and special character areas of the city. You also talked about the use of form-based and Euclidean zoning or a mix is appropriate throughout the city, and the use of light rail and development along West Main Street as a place for experimentation and incubation of ideas. The third is related to economic development and to complete a toolbox that would more effectively promote a business-friendly approach, including the Section 108 funds, which we have secured, in order to encourage and jumpstart economic growth. and also to explore ways for making building safety and our permitting processes more user-friendly. Fourth was to develop a plan to promote new dense housing development in downtown and to leverage our land holdings, because we have about 50 acres in the downtown area, for doing just that. And you suggested probably a need of a minimum of 2,000 units. Fifth was related to special economic zones in West Mesa to allow for more flexibility in zoning and applying fees and cost to redevelopment activities, a focus there. After that, we talked about promoting community events such as Mesa Days, you know, bringing more excitement and pride to Mesa, and really reinstituting city support and community support for events like those. Then we talked about reducing our impact and resources through citywide initiative. This is more the environmental, the reuse, the recycle, repair, develop solar, wind energy, LEED certified types of ordinances and movements. You talked about compact development forms should be encouraged, and partnerships in developing solar energy use within the Mesa Electric Utility. And number eight was improving communication and interaction with the public, and in particular redesign of the city's website to make it more user-friendly and community-oriented rather than government-oriented. And then finally, implementing community facilities districts, and in particular to pay for needed infrastructure on the Mesa Proving Grounds project. But also looking at it from a citywide perspective to help existing neighborhoods upgrade and pay for infrastructure such as fire hydrants and sewers. So those were the high priority objectives. The organization has made some leeway or some progress in each of them. But again, today's discussion is really focused on the council and where you want us to take this from here.
As I go over, as I look at some of these things, once again, taken in the context of when they were made, you know, by design or sheer serendipity, a lot of the things I think we've done and where we're headed fall in line with our initiatives and our objectives. It's obvious that in some of these, that the financial changes has, if not distracted us, has certainly delayed the implementation of some of these. And other things I look at as more long-term, and I think that in most cases we're at least headed in that direction. I'd hope that as we move forward with specific challenges and programs and decisions that we make, that we'll look at these once again, and because each decision, you know, it's not each decision, it's accumulation of the decisions we make and where we're headed. That will determine whether we fit in with what our long-term initiatives are. And I don't know how, what kind of process we can use to make sure we're still heading that. A lot of it is individually to look back on what's important to us and what we define as a council. There are some very specific things in here that maybe we need to sit down, Mr. Brady, and look and see where we are on a staff level as to whether the time is right now to perhaps review and relook at some of these things in light of the changes, organizational changes we made in the last two and a half, three months. Some of those organizational changes actually fell in line with our objectives and were done with our objectives in hand. Some of the organizational changes, I think, have caused us to perhaps put some of these on the shelf, at least for the time being, and maybe we need to look and see how we can mold those back into where we're headed, what we're trying to do. I don't know, Vice Mayor. Thank you.
Well,
save me.
Yeah. I'll give you a break here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, right off the bat, number one, to reconvene the Finance and Future Committee. Our intent was to have already reconvened that, start the process for our budgeting for the coming year, review the role of that committee, and to have the citizen input for all of our operations. But in light of what took place, we had to act quickly, and it kind of put that process on hold. But we still do intend to reconvene that committee and to look towards the future of what we're going to do.
Well, in a lot of ways, the mission of that committee has slightly changed, because like I said, a lot of the things that I think that committee would have come up with, we implemented because of the times
we were,
and the situation.
The issue was forced.
Yeah, and we grabbed hold of it, and kudos to staff and to Mr. Brady for grabbing hold of that and making some very tough decisions and some tough changes. Now, I think that when we get this committee together, their task maybe will be slightly different. And part of it will be to look at what organizational changes we've made and determine whether those are sufficient, whether those are in the right direction. We readily admit that on some of the things we're trying, some of the things we're doing, we're in the exploratory stage. We're forging into new territory. And that's okay, because that's how you progress in advance. But we recognize that we're going to have to continually review that to make sure that we're still heading in the right direction. I can see the committee, this Finance of the Future, assisting us and really giving us an independent outside view as to whether the changes we've made, whether the direction we've made from a budgeting standpoint, from an organizational standpoint, are in line with what we want to accomplish. So that's a great example of something that I think has been delayed due to the circumstances, but its mission and its purpose has not been diminished. It's just been delayed. So, Mr. Brady, your light's on.
Oh,
so.
Sorry. No, really, here you can see
jet lag.
Jet lag. Oh, it's like frostbite. I think is what it is. sorry. These. Just so the council knows, we really, as a staff, look at these and we try to consider, you know, especially when we talk about zoning. If you know today on the agenda, we have the form-based zoning discussion. So it really does become a reference point for us as we begin to bring initiatives to the council. And I think one of the things we need to acknowledge that not everything is necessarily wrapped up in the budget. There's a lot of other policy directional issues that we cover during the year that are not necessarily driven by the budget process itself. For example, form-based zoning. There are other areas of emphasis that are important for us. But it is important for us to get the context of the discussion somewhat early on, because it also establishes priorities for the city. I mean, there's a lot of important things we can be doing. And there's a lot of different ways that we can do what we do. And there's a lot of different interest, both here at council and in the community, for how we deliver, not how we're delivering services, but what we're doing and the variety of different services and programs that we offer. So it certainly is helpful for us to have these discussions with the council to make sure that the way what we're doing, not only just the way we're doing it, but what it is that we're doing, the services we're providing, the policies that we're bringing forward, the initiatives that we're working on, are consistent with what the council's expectations are. So really that's part of the discussion that we're just trying to confirm that with the council today. Is there something here or is there something different out there that either this that we need to realign, adjust, or there's something new that needs to take a higher priority than something that we have here before us? We really have, through the budget process in the last 3 months, as the mayor mentioned, we have significantly shrunk, if you would, our capacities in certain areas. And so we have to be very careful about how much more the additional things we add to it. We can certainly do a lot of great things. We just can't do everything for all purposes. The staff really wants to do everything it can, but obviously we want to provide a good product and help the council and assist you in what you want to accomplish over the next couple of years.
And I appreciate you saying that. And when it comes down to it, like you said, money has a tendency of determining priorities, and that's how it should be. What I hope we don't do is fall into the trap that if we don't have the money to do it the way we've done it before, that it's not important anymore, because that's certainly not the case. And I look at one of these things, for example, our item number 6 on our high priority objectives was to promote community events, parades otherwise. Now, several years ago, a couple, 3 years ago, this council decided not to continue with the financial support of events such as Veterans Day, such as MLK and other activities like that. And this council continued that because of the financial situation. However, I think as we saw with how we worked with the veterans group, the MLK committee and other things, we were able to participate in a meaningful manner without expanding a financial commitment that was really not a feasible course of action, given our financial situation. We still offered existing resources and resources that were available without creating a financial strain to accomplish our objective. And I think we had a very successful parades and events. And we're looking forward in 2009 of having even more successful without the city having a budget line item that says we're going to cut a check for this amount. Mm-hmm. So I hope that as we go through this, that one thing it'll help us to do is recognize that even though we may not have the budget line item that will perhaps allow us to write a check or to expend pure financial resources, that there are other resources this city has and that the people in this city has that can still point us in the direction or keep us pointed in the direction of these the things that are important and helps to succeed those. And that's one thing I think we've at least started out, and I just given one example of ways that we've begun to think differently and not let the budget be the total obstacle that it could be. We could basically just, you know, fold up the tent and say, we're poor, we're not going to do anything. First of all, I don't think that's the personality of the members of this council, nor, as I've worked more and more with the city staff, do I believe it's the nature of the staff to just, you know, shrivel up in a corner and do nothing. So I'm appreciative of the fact that we're going to forge ahead, regardless of our financial situation, and work toward those things that are important for this community. We're going to have to find different ways to do that. We're going to have to get creative. We're going to have to engage other members of the community, the business community, the religious community, the service club community, which I think we have not done a great job of. And when you have money to spend, sometimes it's easy to just forget those aspects of our community and say, that's all right, we'll just do it. Well, we can't do that anymore. But that doesn't mean those things aren't important, and it doesn't mean that we can't do a great job of doing that. So, Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Chris, I think the report we have really is, I think it's a powerful report for positive action in the city, and the strategic initiatives that we identified at our retreat really are the core values that we have identified as helping to drive decisions. And I think if we go back and look at the budget discussions over the last couple of months, those core values have driven the decisions that we've made and have helped move them forward in a positive way, even though it's a difficult time. And I think we've kept sight of those throughout the decision making. But what I think is also equally impressive is the listing of the examples, the program examples under each of the core value or strategic initiative areas that shows, in spite of all the budget difficulties, the staff has continued really a pretty remarkable and multifaceted approach to help implement and continue what we've identified as being important to the community. And so I think the report is really very helpful. The economy and the budget really has overshadowed all the work that is continuing to go on in our community, even with a smaller city. I think it helps also highlight the increased partnerships that with the private sector that city staff has promoted as well. And so I view it really as a very positive statement of what the staff has been doing in concert with the council and the community. And I appreciate all the work in this. Thank you.
Thank you. So as we move forward, what we'd probably like to do is, as we get more into the budget system or budget process, is to, it would be good to remind us as to what we are, as to what these things are. And I don't know if we need to go into a full discussion, but perhaps as we go into that, remind us.
Mayor and Council, what we'll do too is as we bring discussions related to the budget, we'll make sure, we'll try hard to, as we're talking about budget issues, also to put in the context of the strategic.
And that's what I realize, have the discussion in the context of how this fits in with
right.
our strategic.
Mm-hmm. We can do that.
That's why you do them.
Yeah.
That's why you have a mission statement, core value, statement of values, those kind of things, is to make sure that your decisions are made in congruent with those statements. And it's real easy when we're dealing with the day-to-day life and the decision that come up to lose track of that, mm-hmm. to lose sight of that. So I appreciate the reminder. As I'm going through this, I'm looking at things that we've done. I think we've done well. I'm looking at things that I think we have a ways to go. And I think of things where, you know, we could have done a better job. And so thanks for the reminder.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Nat. Any other comments or questions, council members? Okay, next item on the agenda, hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on amending the livestock regulations. Mr. Sheffield.
Mayor, members of the council, Gordon Sheffield, I'm the zoning administrator. How I got involved in livestock regulations, I'm not real sure, but we're here to provide some. Is that what it is?
Okay, you don't need to be sheepish about this. You can move ahead with strength and conviction. Go ahead.
The hits just keep on coming. Real quick, the background on this is the city council adopted something called the Lehigh Subarea Plan back in January of 2006. There were several goals related to what the folks in Lehigh thought were very important to that particular portion of the community. Two of them specifically dealt with livestock regulations. One was to decriminalize livestock regulation penalties, to take them from a misdemeanor penalty to a civil fine, civil fee type of penalty, and that was completed in June of 2008. The second part of that was to take a look at the livestock regulations as a whole, and to take a look at them in the context of making them somewhat similar to, in their terms, successful rural communities. They were aware in particular of a town called Norco, California, that is, the whole town is oriented toward livestock and in particular equestrian activities, and they felt that they had a pretty good livestock code. So what we've done is, the second part, we went to the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee and with some options. And based on the discussion that took place at that committee, they made a recommendation. We're here today to see if the whole council buys into this recommendation before we go off into the ordinance writing process. In particular, the committee recommendation included revision of the rules regarding the raising of infant animals and project animals that are related to 4-H and FFA programs, possibility of a point system to modify some of the livestock ratios beyond what they're doing now, to consider lowering the minimum lot area to a net acre from a full acre, so it would go from 43,560 square feet before you could have livestock to a lot size of 35,000 square feet, and then updating the list of regulated animals because it's somewhat antiquated. The first issue, the one dealing with infant and project animals, the code right now is fairly black and white. It doesn't take into account subtleties like mom and dad cows might have a baby calf. And so two head basically is all you can have, and if they have a calf, that counts as a head of livestock also. And so if you only have an acre and under the current code your ratio maxes out at two, then in theory if mom and dad cow have a baby, that third cow puts you in violation of the ordinance. And so the recommendation in this particular case is to allow the infant animals to stay with the parent animal for a period of a year after the birth. And then in addition to that, to take into account these project animals that are raised by student groups like FFA and 4-H. And so that's the first recommendation. The second issue has to do with the actual ratio of animals per acre. The present requirement basically requires a person to have a full acre of land first, and then on that acre of land they can have two head of livestock. It doesn't matter what kind of livestock, it can have two head. They can add an additional head of livestock for every half acre above that. There's no distinguishment between a large or a small animal in terms of a goat is counted the same as a horse, a sheep is counted the same as a cow. The higher livestock ratios can be requested through a special use permit process which is heard by the Board of Adjustment. And the board has heard, to my knowledge, eight of these, and all have been approved.
Are those all from the same area of the city?
No, actually, six of them are from the Lehigh area. Five of them from the Lehigh area. One is on Broadway and 32nd Street. There's a subdivision there.
Okay.
Another one at University and 39th Street. And then the last one would be University in 88. There's a small subdivision out there that we annexed.
Okay. But this is, so that's more than half, though, from the Lehigh area?
Correct.
I guess in listening to your first thing, this is really, as I'm understanding, a Lehigh-driven issue, problem. I mean, I know that there are ramifications throughout the city, but is it safe to say that
the
issue really generates primarily from Lehigh?
Yes, the majority of it does. However, Vice Mayor Claudia Walters on the prior council, I put together a committee called the Equestrian Committee, and there are people on that committee that were throughout Mesa.
Well, I understand that there's horses out in Southeast Mesa. But where do the problems, I mean, the discussion and everything, are those citywide or are those centered primarily in the Lehigh area?
I'd say probably two-thirds to three-quarters were Lehigh, but it's a significant amount outside of Lehigh as well.
If two-thirds to three-fourths are from Lehigh, what kind of input and what was the role of the Lehigh residents in coming up with these regulations, and where did they, all these point systems and acres and things like that, how did those come up?
These folks asked staff to take a look at the regulations, in particular take a look at the regulations that were...
These folks, which
the,
folks?
The Lehigh folks, as well as the folks on the Equestrian Committee.
And why is there a problem in Lehigh? What do we have going on down in Lehigh that's creating this problem?
The folks in Lehigh, as I understand it, would like to have more horses on their property than the current code would allow.
Okay, so what you're saying is that there are residents in Lehigh who feel that the current codes are too restrictive and they want to expand their offering?
Yes.
Are there people in Lehigh that disagree with that issue?
Yes.
Okay, so we have folks in Lehigh, which has historically been a very rural area, and when it was annexed, and I think I'm about the, well, Councilmember Fenter, well, Jones, three of us were here when Lehigh was not part of the city, and we remember the consternation, I guess would be a good word, as to when Lehigh was brought into the city, and one of the challenges and the issues that Lehigh residents, as I recall, had was the thought that their rural lifestyle would be threatened with city regulation. I see Councilmember Fenter nodding his head. They're not getting along on these livestock things. So do you have people that don't want livestock? You have people who want more livestock?
I don't want to say that they're not getting along. I would say that there are people who believe the existing regulatory structure is adequate.
Okay.
There are other folks out there that would like to make it easier for folks to have more animals on their property than the current code would permit.
Okay.
Mayor, can I
ask Councilmember Higgins.
There's a whole another thing that goes on while they're even looking at it, and that's 4-H type stuff.
Right.
Typically, the kids couldn't have their little 4-H animals because it added too many animals to their house, when in reality, they're just there for a project time of, what, a year?
Yeah.
So they'd have to come into the city, do a board of adjustment case, which costs them $800 to $1,200 for those, which is ridiculous. So those people, because they wanted to follow the rules and their kid wanted to raise a 4-H, calf.
Well, once again, I guess...
You know, so there were ongoing things other than we want more. No, we want our kids to be following the rules.
It gets back to the basic thing that if you have an area that's a rural area, it seems like there's a certain expectation that certain activities are going to exist in a rural area. And I guess what I'm trying to get a handle on is that would seem to be a natural thing that you're going to raise... What did you call them? Little 4-H animals?
4-H.
Okay. cute little 4-H. If they're 4-H animals, they're cute and little. Okay. All right. But that would seem like it would be a natural activity in a rural area, an area that has a history of animals. And so that's what I'm trying to get a hang on as to why all of a sudden we are talking about regulation for what would appear to be natural activities. And I understand that there are some people who would want to take full advantage of that and go beyond what would be normal. The common sense doesn't always prevail. And I'm trying to get a sense as whether we're trying to establish or restore this balance, this normal common sense, or we're trying to overregulate the heck out of what should be a normal activity. And Councilmember Richens is raising his hand. And since this is his, Lehigh is his district, I'll let him chime in, and then
sure.
Mr. Sheffield, you can go.
To me, as I've watched this, and I inherited this process from Vice Mayor Walters, and as I've gotten to know our Lehigh residents, this is really the driving feeling behind strategic initiative number two that talks about letting Lehigh be Lehigh and let these special character areas. And I think you hit it about regulation. This is really an effort to restore, deregulate, especially the 4-H animals. I mean, having to do these bizarre Board of Adjustment cases in order to do those and come up with a system that makes a lot more sense than the rigid system that we have in place now of just two heads per acre. I really like the point system. I was one that wanted to see us work on that because it really takes into account the different ratios. And I know it can get convoluted after a while. I don't know, as you guys read your staff reports, I don't know if it was easy to follow, but because I've been so involved in this, this makes perfect sense. But I really think it's an effort to restore and put back some of the historic uses in Lehigh, but do it in a way that is respectful of those who aren't real loving of the lifestyle around livestock.
I got a question on that. If they're not loving lifestyle around livestock, why do they live in Lehigh?
Great point.
I mean, isn't this? I have a little bit of an issue when we're asked to solve everyone's problems. This is life. And if I'm going to move to Lehigh,
check the history.
Well, drive through the neighborhoods. It's a rural area. There's open canals. There's no sidewalks. That was what it was intended to stay. I guess I've got issues, and I understand that there are extremes we need to guard against.
Mayor, if I...
Yeah, please chime in on this, because we're trying to get to the base of it. I appreciate all the specific rules.
I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the balance, because livestock, the livestock ordinance applies to 170 square miles of plant.
Well, and that's what would be my next follow-up question is to...
And what we're trying to do is to try to find that balance to achieve the goals that the Lehigh residents are trying to get, which is to allow a more livestock or equestrian-oriented lifestyle in their portion of the city, and yet at the same time balance those regulations so that we're not permitting too many animals in other portions of the city that don't necessarily appreciate that lifestyle.
Well, I would ask the same question in the other areas of the city. I mean, if you're living in Councilmember Fenter's district where there are a mix... You got the All Red Farms there on Southern. You got the 32nd Street and Broadway, which historically was a rural area and was surrounded by the city and brought into the city. I mean, how do we maintain the historical nature of those properties while maintaining this balance? I mean, I'm seeing that we're having a real tough time coming up with a scenario that fits the Lehigh model, which is unique because it's the largest area of the city that is pure rural that I can see. There are pockets elsewhere. And I mean, discounting the county horse areas out in Councilmember Higgins' area, which is county and which was horse, but we'll have these same issues coming up. But Lehigh is somewhat of a unique area in the sense that of its sheer size, it's physically separated from other areas. It's unique in that nature. How do we take into account that without creating unintended consequences by trying to come up with a citywide regulatory scheme that somehow might inadvertently allow activities where there historically have not been activities? I take it that's one of your challenges, as you've mentioned.
Yes, and that you're two slides ahead of me.
So, only two?
Well,
okay.
At least, okay. But the point is that we want to kind of describe some of the basics that we have now and then kind of describe some of the recommendations that the committee felt would achieve the very goals that you're talking about. That we are where we try to accomplish that balance so that we're not creating unintended consequences, yet at the same time we're loosening the regulations up enough for those areas that do have livestock so they can appreciate that livestock a little bit more.
Well, let's get back to the basis. Ms. Spinner, I mean, in this scheme, do we have to have a citywide, are there ways through established or not established subdistricting we can have differences in rules and regulations, or is this something that if we make a rule, it's got to apply citywide?
If we adopt the code, it has to apply citywide. If you're looking at a zoning change, for example, an overlay district, so that you could designate Lehigh or place an overlay district on the Lehigh area, that would only apply to Lehigh or any other areas of the city that the council specifically placed the overlay. The consequence of that is that if it's a zoning overlay, it could come with Prop 207 implications, or it does come with Prop 207 implications, because any change to a zoning law, which the zoning overlay would be, would then attach Prop 207 implications if and when the council then chooses to change that overlay. So the way that the code is written now, the livestock privilege is found in Title 8. It is a privilege. It is not a zoning right. So changes to the code does not have Prop 207 implications. If we move this to the zoning code, then yes, there would be.
And we have an existing Lehigh overlay that does not include these things. So what you're saying is if we went back in and embedded these regulations or these guidelines within that overlay, all of a sudden it becomes a zoning issue, and then we have Prop 207.
Mayor, that's correct, Mayor.
And so everyone understands Prop 207 was the voter initiative that talks about potential liability if there's a change in land use that creates a
that may decrease
diminution
the property
of
value.
Yeah,
that's correct.
And you know, you could argue both sides of this, and that's the problem with Prop 207. Does this increase property values, or does this diminish property values? And my guess is you could make good arguments on both sides as it relates to livestock. Okay. Well, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you. Let's get to Councilmember Richards.
That's all I was going to say.
Oh.
I was going to talk about Prop 207.
Okay. All right.
Mayor, just
so go ahead. Let's catch up on
quick
the
slides. Quick correction. There's not an overlay district for Lehigh.
Oh, there's not?
There's not.
There's a sub-area. I'm sorry.
Sub-area. It's a sub-area plan.
Sub-area plan. Okay. Thank you for that.
It's a policy issue. It's not
gotcha.
An ordinance.
It's not an actual ordinance.
It's a set of goals. There's no regulatory structure associated with it.
Thank
Just
you.
Quick question also.
Gordon, Higgins, yeah.
Anytime there's a full acre in the whole entire city, the same rules apply.
Correct.
But just because there's more full acre lots in Lehigh, it tends to be, tend to talk about Lehigh. But anywhere where, I mean, out in District 5, there's some in 6. Mm-hmm. Anytime there's a full acre, you can have the same thing that the Lehigh residents have, obviously,
correct.
As long as there's not a HOA with CC&Rs or whatever.
Yes.
Well, it's base lot, one full acre.
From the city regulatory standpoint, the livestock regulations apply to any property that has at least an acre of land.
Right, okay.
Regardless of the zoning category?
Regardless of the zoning category.
Okay.
You can have horses in the R16 district if you have a full acre of land.
Okay.
Today?
Yes. The livestock are irregardless of zoning. What we do
commercial,
is yes,
anything.
Mm-hmm.
It disregards zoning.
Yes.
So if you have a vacant piece of land, regardless of how it is zoned, these you can use. You can put livestock on it.
Yeah,
which makes sense. Which is why you go down on baseline and see winter grazing of animals and things like that.
Sure.
On property that is certainly not. Well, maybe it is farmland, but even if it weren't, you could still come and graze sheep and other things.
The water treatment plant.
Which, by the way, how would that affect that?
I'm sorry? How would it affect what?
On seasonal grazing and things like that, do those fall under our regulations?
The improvements fall under zoning. The ability to graze the livestock on the property does not.
Does not. How about the ability to have goats on water plants?
No.
Oh, okay, good. I want to make sure we're not regulating
the
ourselves
city,
out of
the city's not violating its own ordinance.
Grass chewing business.
No. Okay. Real quick look at adjacent cities. Phoenix allows one head of livestock for every 10,000 square feet. Scottsdale does not regulate livestock. Tempe allows none on the first half acre, and then one large or two small animals per each 6,000 square feet. Chandler allows 2.5 head per acre, or 6.2 if you're in a AG zoning district. And in Gilbert, they also have one per 10,000 square feet, or they also have the requirement that if you have a smaller animal like a goat or a sheep, they allow pretty much double that, 8.7 per acre.
What's the Maricopa County regulation? Do you know?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, because their regulations are a little hard to find, quite honestly. I think it's 2.5, but recommendation for this was to keep the existing ratio at 2 head, to keep the special use permit option for the higher ratios, but also to take a look at possibility of a point system that would take into account the effects of large and small animals, effectively doubling the ability to have smaller animals on the property but still keeping them proportional to the size of the property itself. This is just a real quick points idea. The idea would be that the number of land points would always have to equal or exceed the number of animal points that a person has. The idea would be to say that you could have 4 points per acre, a portion of an acre, and then the animal points would be based on the head and the type of animal that you're talking about. So small animals, 1 point each. Large animals are 2 point each. And then if we use the existing ratio we have for things like barnyard fowl, ducks, and chickens, current code allows 20 per acre, so that's where the 0.05 comes from. So if you add all those up together in the example that I gave you in your staff report, I gave an example of a 2.7-acre site, and the person wanted to keep 4 horses, 2 sheep, and 3 ducks. Under the present code, that type of combination would not be allowed, primarily because the number of animals or the points for those animals exceeds the point allowance for the land. If you calculated all that up, it came to, under the present code, that's 6 head of livestock. The code for 2.7 acres would only allow 5 head, so that sixth livestock head would not be allowed, whatever it was. So I'd have to get rid of a horse or a sheep. Under the proposed revision, what we would try to do is take into account, again, the smaller animal. So with 2.7 acres, that would translate into 10.8 land points. 4 horses, there's 2 points each, that's 8 animal points. 2 sheep times 1 point is 2 animal points. 3 ducks, we end up with 10.15 is less than 10.8.
That and Gordon, combination on the acre site, is that calculated, let's say it's an undeveloped acreage or it's a side yard, is that still calculated using 35,000 square feet as an acre, or does that go back to your normal 43,560?
43,560.
Okay, so it's an acre lot.
Right.
You could, if it's a one lot and it's a commercial or a residential acre lot, we'll allow 35,000 to equate an acre. But if you're
this is just strictly taking a full acre and converting that into.
Okay, so dimensional, you're going to look at it and you're going to come up with this calculation. All right. Okay. Got it. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I have a dumb question. In terms of points, how do you calculate ostriches, since we have those in my council district and those are bigger than ducks?
We would, quite honestly, I'm not real sure how to assign a point value to an ostrich yet. However, we would probably take a look at, there are similar systems to this. And so we would probably take a look at how folks have realized that. More than likely, it'd end up.
Well, I think we would, you know what, this is. We got to get on top of this. We got to pull our heads out of the sand and get on top of this.
Yeah,
I'm
leaving. Oh, man.
You are tired.
Okay.
I was afraid this was going to happen.
Hey, you know what? We laugh now, but I think one of my concerns is this going to happen and happen and happen as residents come in and ask very legitimate questions.
Sure.
And I mean that's the challenge I think we have is come up with a balance. But Board of Adjustments is going to have these. I don't know how often they'll come up, but this is not going to be an issue that's going to be taken lightly. They're going to be confronted with the same question all the time.
Well, I think they're trying to avoid Board of Adjustment cases
by coming up with some rules and make, you know, this could be a rule and administratively you could figure out what an ostrich is. And we're glad we have staff that is geared up to make those kind of determinations. Thank you.
We get interesting questions on my side of the table. If there aren't any questions about the point system, I'll go ahead and move on to the next issue, which was the possibility of lowering the lot threshold. Again, currently it's a full acre.
Okay, so this is where it gets into my question. What you're saying is that before there was a prohibition on anything less than a full acre, and what we're saying is that if you're 35,000 square feet or more, you can have livestock, and then we go into the
yes.
Then we go into to
then
the
we would go into the point
okay,
system.
Gotcha. Got
so,
it. All right.
So you again, you're allowed to apply for a special use permit for the smaller sites. The part of the criteria included evidence of past livestock use. The recommendation of the committee was to reduce the minimum area to a net acre. Now, staff wanted to make sure that the council understood some of the consequences of this, and that's where these maps come from. If you take a look at this is a citywide look at this. The blue areas are the areas of the city that include full acre lots. The areas of red are the areas where you expand the livestock eligibility to to include 35,000 square foot lots. If we took a look at this and some specific areas, this is how it would affect the Lehigh area. You can see that there would be a significant number of lots that would now become eligible to have livestock in Lehigh. And then kind of moving further on, if you take a look at the citrus area with the idea that Val Vista would be kind of the central focal point of that, would create a significant number of lots that would become eligible in that part of town. Taking a look at the desert uplands and trying to discount for things like retention basins and those types of things, this does not include county islands. This is just areas that are within the incorporated portion of the city. It adds a few, but not quite as many. And then one other is to take a look at the central south area of Mesa down along Broadway and Southern Avenue. And you can see that there are a significant number back in that area also, including the subdivision that we talked about, which is this area right here already has a special use permit, but also include the entirety of the Heritage Acres subdivision down at 32nd and Baseline.
Okay. Councilman Richens?
If a HOA is in place in one of these areas, take, for example, Red Mountain Ranch or Los Angeles area out there, and they already have CC&Rs that specifically prohibit livestock, even if they had a 35,000-acre lot, would they be able to keep it?
Well, under city regulations, yes, but under the Homeowners Association would be responsible for enforcing the CC&R.
Okay, so the CC&R would
probably
trump the city?
Yes.
Okay. I'm getting an attorney nod back there. Thank you. So people in Los Angeles, even if we change this to 35,000 square foot lots, they wouldn't be able to keep.
I'm not sure what their CC&R says.
Yeah,
if they do,
their CC&R prohibits it. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so just and make sure that the options would be to lower the threshold citywide, keep the SUP option, in other words, keep the standard at a full acre. Still require folks to apply for a special use permit for those lots between 35,000 and a full acre. The other possibility was what we discussed earlier, was to develop an equestrian overlay district and then go through a full zoning process to give special recognition to those areas through a zoning process to do that. And leave Debbie explain some of the ramifications of that dealing with Prop 207.
Councilmember Fenter.
With regard to, you say a special use permit for over 35,000 square feet. Why couldn't we just say 35,000 square feet? You know, having taken my whole neighborhood through this, and you remember the whole process, there are city acres, not to go into all the background on it, but I think couldn't we find just say 35,000 square feet for those city-type acres and not have to have it a special use permit?
Yes, that's what the recommendation
is. Oh, that is the recommendation. Yes. I misunderstood you. I thought you said there'd be a special use permit.
No,
for those
we just want to make sure that we wanted to clarify the options that we presented to the committee.
Thank you.
Mayor.
Councilmember Higgins.
Gordon, would there be a time where for public comment on some of these areas? Because, you know, I've been chatting with some folks about it, and there are areas that don't have CC&Rs, like literally between McKellips and Green. I think it's in your district, between Dave, between McKellips and Brown and Gilbert and Stapley going that way. There's an occasional lot where you actually, you know, there's not a CC&R overriding that whole area, and there are the lots that would be affected. And those aren't neighborhoods that somebody currently has chickens, and they were saying to me that they can't imagine having a horse next door because you didn't buy into that area with the assumption you'd have, you know, livestock. Mm-hmm. You know, occasionally, you know, every neighborhood, even with CC&R, somebody will have two chickens in the backyard, and as long as they don't make a lot of noise, no one cares. But when you all of a sudden have a horse next door in a normal neighborhood that you didn't expect would ever be there. So I guess I just would like to, you know, have a public comment period. I don't worry planning on that.
Our purpose today was just to get council direction so we can start developing the ordinance. In terms of public participation, we can certainly go through a public participation process similar to what we do for a text amendment to the zoning code, if that's what the council wants to do, and certainly make that well known and and actually go out and seek those comments from those areas if that's what the council directs us to do.
I'm just concerned with, you know, the typical neighborhood that all of a sudden your next door neighbor is going to show up with a horse because we changed our rules. Now, majority of my district, they all have HOAs and CC&Rs, and where I live, even though it's a big area that would all be affected, you know, the CC&R strictly say no livestock. So we're covered. I mean, we're covered against all of a sudden having the neighbor throw a horse in the backyard. But some of these, you know, just some of these areas aren't. So that's my only concern, that, you know, you lived in a neighborhood for years and all of a sudden someone moves a horse next door.
We can certainly try to publicize this in a broad possible way. And we've also taken a little bit longer period of time once the ordinance is actually written to seek that public comment so that we're not coming back to council tomorrow, for example, to do this.
But one thing this will do for us is those county islands that are on the edge around District 5, is it now does we won't have that inhibitor for those people to annex in because now they have the livestock ordinance that meets the county. They'll be able to bring their horse, you know, they'll be able to come into the city without the getting rid of a horse or two.
Yeah, Councilmember Higgins, the city's regulations will line up more closely with the county's regulations. So you're correct that there wouldn't be that hurdle or that consideration that would prohibit people or dissuade people from annexing.
Right.
Okay. Councilman Richens.
I hear what you're saying, especially in those neighborhoods. I'm over here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The blue one. This blue light. My cup runs over. Yeah. You need a significant infrastructure to keep a horse, you know, and I don't think you're going to see a lot of neighbors just move a horse into their backyard. You know? you hope not. I guess it's a possibility, and it's I get one of the risks we take. But for the most part, you know, the thing that kind of swings me is the annexation. So the city acre piece and some of the historic uses of livestock that people have had in the past and then come into the city and lost. And I think restoring that has really struck a balance. And that's really what we've tried to do is how do you strike a balance for all these things over 170 square mile planning area. So I really want to say thanks to Gordon because he's bloodied his forehead on this project for several years. And, you know, we laugh and joke about it. But it's really been a very contentious, complicated issue, and I just wanted to really thank Gordon for the research and work that he's done to get it to this point. It's taken a lot of public input and staff time to get it here, and that's why let's make sure we're very thoughtful in the way that we go about this, because I want to show respect to the citizens who worked on this committee to get it to this point.
And I don't. I agree with Councilmember Richens, and I understand the trials and tribulations of talking about this. I guess what causes me to almost make this, and I don't want to say comical, is that we're opening up areas to the city that have not historically had this issue that now will have this issue. So are we solving one problem and creating another? And I look at Councilmember Fenter's district, where many of those communities were developed as custom lot communities long before HOAs were either fashionable or existed, but where livestock use on commercial 35,000 square foot acre lots was not a norm. And now all of a sudden, are we opening that up where we're going to create huge more conflict than we're solving, because now we have whole neighborhoods where somebody does move in not knowing the history, and all of a sudden they do want to. Let's say they don't want to put a horse on there, but they want to put a couple of sheep on there, or goats. And they've introduced something to a neighborhood that for 30, 40 years has not had problems with goats. We laugh about it, but in many ways, are we creating that potential? There's a lot of red on these maps where I don't think you'll find a single animal right now. Now we're saying is, oh, by the way, we're advertising, it's okay to have animals on this. Now we can say that people aren't going to bring an animal in, but I would be shocked if someone didn't show up with a donkey on one of these lots. And the question is that what we're doing? Because maybe I'm missing it. Maybe I'm not understanding what we have. We tend to rely on CC&Rs and those kind of things, and maybe that'll take place, but I'm not sure in a lot of these older neighborhoods in District 2 and District 1 that we have those in existence.
I just don't think there's a lot of parcels. I mean, if we really got down to it, took all the ones out that had CCNRs prohibiting it, and got down, I mean, you're probably...
You think it's a limited number.
About 100 parcels in citywide. I just don't think there's that many.
Okay. Councilmember Fender, your read on it? I mean, is that... Because if that's the case, then I'm worrying about nothing.
No, and I appreciate your thoughts. I was thinking through it as I looked at some of these. I don't think it's as prevalent of a concern of mine. I mean, I have been up to my ears in this over the last few years about this, like with Councilman Richens, and I think we're moving in the right direction. I don't want to discount that there may be an incident here or there. I have learned two things in life. You don't mess with people's irrigation, and you don't mess with their animal rights. And if you want to see the shotguns come out and the controversy rise, and so I think it's important. Mesa's history, agrarian, especially in our district and down in District 1, this is a good thing. I think we're moving in the right direction. I like some of the check and balances that are there. So thanks for asking, Mayor.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
Councilmember Higgins.
Just out of curiosity, if it was, if there was an area that had a few of these lots that now could have livestock, that doesn't say their HOA couldn't vote whatever it was, 80% to change their HOA rights to say you can't have livestock.
That's a possibility, but if they don't have an HOA, then that option's not available.
Right.
Yeah. What we have are three situations, as I understand it. We have areas that were developed without an HOA, which most of our city is not covered by an HOA. If it has an HOA, odds are, I've never seen an HOA that allowed livestock as far as the HOA documents. I've never seen one. I'm sure one may, if it's a equestrian HOA, then that's one thing, unless there was a special use. So I don't think that that's an issue. Probably in the last 30 years, even custom lot subdivision, or maybe even 40 years, probably have CCNRs that restrict livestock use. Most of the ones I've seen do. I'm sure there are those out there that maybe don't, but it seems like it was sort of common as you recorded a plat that you had CCNRs that restricted, they had use restrictions which included livestock. So that's probably taken care of. So we're talking about those communities or those plots of land, those neighborhoods that neither have CCNRs nor do they have an HOA. I don't have any empirical data. My guess is that those situations are few and far between. Or they're already using livestock, and that's the reason they don't have a CCNR, like Lehigh, things like that. So you're probably right that maybe I'm overstating the potential. Although it does exist, it's probably pretty slim. Would that be an accurate description of the situations that
sounds
exist?
Sounds like a pretty good summary to me, Mayor.
Okay. All righty. Gotcha.
Okay. Okay, issue D, which is basically just updating the animals listed. The existing list is fairly narrow. For example, it uses the term neat animals to refer to cattle. Over the years, past city managers have come to the zoning administrator and asked for interpretations as to how to regulate certain animals like llamas and rheas and ostriches and potbelly pigs. And we've provided that service, but those animals aren't specifically listed. And if someone said, they called up and the ZA didn't happen to be available that day and they wanted to find out if they could keep a potbelly pig, unless someone already knew about that interpretation, they couldn't find it anywhere in the ordinance. And so the idea about updating the list basically is to take these interpretations and incorporate them and codify them into the ordinance. That information becomes available to the general public.
Let me ask you this. Would we ever consider, and I know we're now coming real close to over the line here, but there are all animals are not created equal in the sense that there are some that are more of a nuisance, either through sound, activity, or smell, than other animals.
Correct.
Have we considered perhaps identifying some particularly obnoxious types of animals and saying... because I know, for example, ducks leave their trail is much more obnoxious than chickens. Well, boy, I just offended all the duck and chicken lovers out there. So let's assume, hypothetically, the ducks were different than chickens, okay? Would, have we discussed that or treaded upon that? Or is that a place we don't want to go?
Chickens, geese, and ducks are just all kind of lumped into the category of barnyard fowl.
Okay.
And so that, and that's how we've approached it in the past. We haven't become any...
But that hasn't come up as to whether, even on the small animals, whether there were some that were... We haven't tried to create a grade or anything.
With pigs.
Yeah, there's currently a prohibition of pigs. The ordinance also addresses, for example, non-human primates, and there are specific requirements for non-human primates that are in the ordinance we haven't even talked about. But and there are specific...
Chimpanzees.
Orangutans,
gorillas, things like that.
You name it.
Okay.
So there's special requirements for those.
Okay.
But no, outside of that, no.
Okay.
So we're just recommending that we would go forward and we would update the list. We would incorporate these interpretations, codify them in a way so that people can find the information and understand what the requirements are for those particular animal groups.
Councilmember Fenter?
Again, on updating the animals, we don't allow swine or pigs, right, in the city already.
With the exception of pot-bellied pigs. That's been done by interpretation, and we would probably make an exception for project animals for 4-H.
Yeah, the 4-H.
And then roosters, right?
We don't regulate roosters. There might be some sound regulations that are related to them, but there's nothing in the animal ordinance about roosters.
Thank you.
Gordon, is that something we can actually do? I actually heard an NPR story just the other morning talking about they can have chickens, but they can't have roosters.
If that's the direction of the council, we can try to develop a regulation.
We've had a rooster two doors down. Roosters don't crow just in the morning. They crow all night long. So I can see where if all of a sudden, you know, we opened up the area to more livestock and all of a sudden the neighbor has a rooster, we'd have some major issues. So
we can probably try to incorporate limitations on roosters. Sure.
That would be awesome.
Well, can't you already have chickens and roosters without regulation now, presently?
You don't have to have the minimum acre. You can have 10 per half acre is the ratio. And you don't, but there's no minimum. So it's, if you have a third acre of a lot, you can have a couple of roosters on it.
Okay. It's already exists.
Well, as you alluded to, that's going to fall under your sound ordinance, where you have barking dogs and such, that becomes a disturbing the peace issue that needs to be regulated a little differently.
Correct.
Sure.
So, the long term is, staff is asking, is the full council or the consensus of council comfortable with the direction provided by the committee? The Community and Neighborhood Services Committee, and would you give us the direction to go forward with an ordinance along these lines, with these recommendations, or are there some modifications that we need to make before we start preparing an ordinance?
I think you're good. The recommendation of the Neighborhood Services Board was to move ahead, not that. So I would agree to move ahead since we already have kind of discussed that.
Well, I think that we vetted this pretty good today, asked questions. There's not a perfect solution in my mind, but, you know, it appears to me that we have a problem that needs to be addressed, however we address it. If Councilmember Richens and Councilmember Fenter, and I know it applies to everybody's district in one way or another, but you feel, since Lehigh was the birth of this, you're saying you feel comfortable that this satisfies those things, and the other council members, you don't think it creates other problems, unintended consequences, or known consequences that go beyond what the good that we're coming out of this. If I don't hear from that, then I guess go ahead and let's prepare an ordinance, and then we can deal with that specifically.
Yeah, I specifically really like the point system and how it's been developed, and it seems convoluted, but I think you get used to the formulas and the animal list is updated, you know what everything equals, you know, three ducks equal one ostrich, whatever. I think that'll really help quite a bit.
I just warn us that, you know, we will have people come up. HOAs is one issue. CCNRs, the city is constantly asked to try and enforce CCNRs, which is not our role, but it's something that falls in our lap all the time. And my guess is that with this, if we do have people who come in that are not within an HOA, we will be asked to
try and enforce CCNRs, and I just want to, that's my observation.
Sure.
We just need to be aware of that and recognize that's coming. I know you deal with that on other issues all the time, and I don't see that this being any different. If anything, this may be a little bit more challenging.
Sure.
Because we have an ordinance that would allow it, a CCNR doesn't allow it, and all of a sudden we'll have to tell somebody, you have to take some other out. That's what courts are for.
Yep.
Not a very nice and pretty solution, but I don't, Ms. Spinner, I don't know what else we have in this situation.
You're right, Mayor. The city cannot enforce CCNRs.
And we shouldn't be enforcing CCNRs. Whether we could or couldn't, we shouldn't be doing that. Okay, so move ahead with that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The next item is to hear presentation, discuss, and provide direction on form-based codes. Mr. Sheffield.
Mayor, council members.
And this is a completion of the presentation you started last week, so thank you
for being here. There's been a lot of discussion about form-based codes, and the council came across an example of a form-based code when they were considering the Mesa Proving Grounds project, because they incorporated form-based principles into their approach to that particular planned community. Staff's purpose in bringing this subject back is primarily to kind of go back and make sure that everybody understands the basic of what constitutes a form-based code, as well as some of the implementation issues that are related to that. Real quick, basic parts of a zoning code, there's definitions, you have zoning districts, you have land use regulations, there are design controls, you try to take care of special circumstances with things like conditional uses, special use permits, things like that. It describes processing requirements, as well as there, you generally have a map, and there's that map describes specific districts and divides the city into these various zoning categories or zoning districts. The basic types of zoning regulations you'll come across will include something called a Euclidean zoning code, which is the traditional zoning code that we all have. This is based on a Supreme Court case that was decided in 1926. The principal consideration in a Euclidean code is that there is separation of land uses. And so the reason for doing that is to minimize the impacts between dissimilar activities. Secondary to that is the bulk requirements, how you actually control the forms that take place on the property itself. So that's not the principal idea, but it's the second idea. As a kind of an expansion of the idea, primarily between the 60s and the 1980s, the concept of what's called performance zoning came about. And what this really does is it tries to address those spaces that are in between districts. And the reason that it does that is it's trying to create buffers between these activities, saying basically that if you put a commercial use next to a residential use, there needs to be some sort of something there that buffers the commercial activities, the noise, the traffic, and those types of things from what people generally expect to see in a residential district. So it tries to discourage conflicting land uses. In the beginning of the 1990s and on into the current day, there's been a concept that's been evolving called a form-based code. Some people call these neo-traditional codes. The idea is to get back to the idea of planning a town similar to what you would have had during when many of the towns were founded in the West during the 1800s and 1700s. The principal consideration in these types of core codes is that the building form comes first. You really don't consider the land use first. You consider the form. Again, that flips the priorities of these types of things. So you're not considering the use first. You're not considering how the building is going to be used. You can see how the building is going to look, where the building is going to be placed, and then you figure out how you use the building secondary to that. And so just because you have a structure, there may be multiple different ways that you can use that building. The second thing that they look at is the building form and context. And what they're looking at here is when you organize all of these buildings together, what are you left with? So you're left with those spaces that are in between. How can those spaces be better designed so that they work together in a synergistic fashion as opposed to creating barriers and separations between activities? So then you get to the third consideration or tertiary consideration is that how can you use these buildings through time? So that even so, for example, the classic example they give are a lot of the factory buildings they might have in Massachusetts, which now have been converted into residential lofts. Well, when they were originally constructed, they weren't constructed for that purpose, but you had these large brick buildings with big glass windows that covered, that had large spaces that were in between that. And they found that if they put up a couple of partitions between that, they would have wonderful large residential lofts. They considered the use of the building through time. Well, if you were in a strictly Euclidean zoning district, they would have to rezone that building in order to be able to use it for a residential purpose, even though it wasn't necessarily designed for that to begin with. But under a form-based code, that option might exist because you would consider that option under the possible options of uses for that particular building form. So you're not separating those things out. So again, you consider the use of the building through time. Where we're going with the zoning code update is we're trying to develop what's called a hybrid code. And the idea is that because we've got a Euclidean code right now, for the most part, it's hard to get rid of that entirely. We just can't throw everything out that we have now. So we have to somehow recognize that fact and make accommodations for it. The other thing to consider on this is sometimes you really do want separations between land uses. Sometimes the best way to deal with these types of things is to put up a wall, put up a big landscape setback, and put in lots of trees. If we put a residential, to name a notorious example, if we put a porta potty location right across the canal from high dollar residential lots, there's probably going to be a land use conflict, and there has been one, and we've come across that. And the best way to deal with that is to put up a wall and put up lots of trees and make sure, and hopefully one can't see the other. So what we're trying to do with these hybrid codes is develop the tools that best fit the job so that we have not just one tool to address these issues as they come up. Again, I've talked about these. The present Mesa zoning code is primarily Euclidean and performance oriented. The assumption is to separate the land uses. The other part of the code that we have right now is it tends to drive things into a public hearing process. Staff has some authority but doesn't have a lot of authority to approve projects. And so if someone comes to us with a development idea, oftentimes we're into a design review board case or board of adjustment case or planning and zoning city council case to approve the site plan. And so because some of those site planning ideas go through that public hearing process, it discourages reuse of activities or the new use of an activity because you've got a four-month process at the tail end and you're not really sure what the outcome is going to be. And so it tends to sometimes dissuade people from even applying for these types of applications instead of going through the process. With the updated zoning code, we're going to try to balance the ideas. We're going to try to also encourage that adjacent projects build into each other instead of separating. So we're trying to build on the strengths of the neighboring uses instead of trying to drive things apart. We're also trying to make things as more of an administrative process as possible so that not everything has to go through public hearings, that we have enough planning, enough standards in place that we can approve something without necessarily having to take something to city council all the time. Some zoning basics. The big thing here is that zoning is a three-step process. You develop a zoning ordinance. You adopt a map that actually gives geographic location to the individual districts themselves. And then the third step is the site plan approval. Philosophically, there are some distinctions between a Euclidean and performance code and a form-based code. Again, you're regulating land use first. The building form is secondary. You're trying to separate things. The spaces between are an afterthought because those codes really don't consider what you do in between activities. In addition, Euclidean codes tend to be technically worded, and some people think that they're difficult to understand. Form-based codes or neo-traditional codes, again, you're regulating the building form first. You do consider the spaces in between because you're considering how this affects things overall. It does encourage a mixture of land uses. You're not trying to drive individual land activities away from each other. It considers things through time. It tends to be very graphic oriented. It uses a lot of diagrams, and the language is not quite as technically oriented. The other philosophical distinction, form-based codes tend to be prescriptive. They provide direction. They tell you what you can do, as opposed to a Euclidean code, which tends to be more restriction oriented. They tell you what you can't do, and then you try to figure out what you can do after that. And so by telling folks what they can do, generally it makes it a little bit more easier for them to understand what they can do with their property. They can be a little bit more predictive from that standpoint. Again, just if you're trying to develop a form-based code, same type of thing, you have an overview or administration section. there's a regulating plan that tends to be a very important component of this, and that tends to be the geographic base of the actual code. You have building form standards, you have public space and street standards that go along with this, so not only are you dealing with the private realm, so to speak, the private part of the property, but to a certain extent you're also getting into some of the street standards that are associated with this and the relationship of the building to that street. So you don't draw a line, so to speak, an artificial line, and say we're not going to consider this past the property line. They consider the building and its relationship to the street and the street and the relationship to its building. More formally, you'll get into land use matrices that talks to you about the different options and how you, the building forms can be used. If we get into more detail, we can talk about pattern books and some of the architectural details. Just some real quick examples. This is from Duane Platter Zyberg and Company have put together something called Smart Code version 9.2. You can download this from the internet. This just is a kind of a model code that people use that gives an idea of what a form-based code it is and how it can be structured. Some of the tables that I've shown you are examples of what people would go to find out how can they use their property. If they were in certain different, what are called transect districts, how they can, where, what part of the property can be used, how tall the property can be, so they get an idea of the actual forms that are allowed on their building. Again, we get into street diagrams, the placement of trees that go along with that. There's takes into account the public and the private realms for frontage from that standpoint. And then we get into the term that form-based codes use to divide themselves up as a transect as opposed to a district. And the reason they use this term is the idea behind a transect is if you take a cross-section of the community, if you were to actually take a line, for example, and take it, take Main Street, and take Main Street from the Tempe Canal and go all the way out to Meridian Road, and you were to sit here and to map that, then you would get an idea for the different types of intensities of development that would go up and down as you went across the city. And if you divided those into areas, you'd find out areas of commonality between that. So that if you use their terminology, a T6 or an urban core zone would be those areas that are most intense, and a T1 would be the areas that are most natural. And there would be a gradation between that. And so you'd actually take those things into account, and you basically build your forms around each of those individual transects or districts. From more of a vertical viewpoint, this is an idea where in the upper right corner, or I'm sorry, upper left corner of this, you get the idea of it's more rural, more natural. And again, you come into gradations or transitions across the community until you get into the full urban type of zone where you get the most impact, you get the most verticality in your buildings. You're using up most of the land, or what some people call land use efficiencies. To do this from a mapping standpoint, they develop something called a regulating plan. And this is where you would actually take the transect and actually apply it to areas. These tend to have a little bit more fine grain to them than your typical zoning maps. Whereas you might have wide areas of the city that might be zoned R16 or R2 or some of the Euclidean districts that we use now, regulating maps tend to take into account things such as what kind of street am I next to? What kind of transition from that street do I make into the next neighborhood? How quickly do I make that transition? And so then that's where you get into some of these different transects. And so, for example, if you take a look at this, this is from Arlington, Virginia, in what they call their town center regulating plan. And the area that's red down the center of that is the area where you're going to see their most intense urban forms. The areas that are just past that, the areas that are in blue, those are the areas that, where you're going to find the transition from the most urban forms into the little bit the more suburban forms. And then when you finally get out to the areas that are a little that are the orange color, those are the areas where you're going to find a more residential character. So again, you're making the gradation, and you're doing that fairly quickly, almost on a lot-by-lot basis, as opposed to kind of the machete approach that a normal zoning code takes, where you're kind of hacking at things and you're not really trying to make a fine grain out of it. Again, this is a little bit more of a close-up, and you can see how it kind of takes kind of a lot-by-lot approach in how you develop a regulating plan. What comes out of that are, from these different transects, is like this is just a real quick comparison between what they call transect 3 and transect 5. You can see transect 5, which is on the right, it's a much more urban form. They're talking about four-story buildings. They're talking about buildings that are fairly close to the street, but these can still have a residential character. You compare that to the T3, which is a less intense transect. You're only talking about two-story buildings, and you're setting the building back from the road. So you get more of that residential or more of that suburban type of character. But then each one of these individual pages, you can see that it'll actually get into different approaches as to where you can place the building on the property, where the parking can be on the property, and what kind of development is expected with each of the transects. To implement a form-based code, really what we're talking about is establishing standards, and that's probably something that we can address as part of the zoning code update, and that's and what we intend to do that. We would probably, you know, include the administration sections, the definition sections. We would establish these different form standards that would go along with each of these transects, and we would develop a land use matrix to go along with that. The trick in doing this is the actual application of these form districts into geographical areas within the city. And that's done through the regulating plan. And that is a planning process. And that's not something that we would likely expect to be part of the zoning code update, because we're taking these districts or these transects and translating that onto actual lots, where we begin this prescriptive process of saying this is where the expectation is for the individual buildings. That does involve a full planning process. We have to go out and study the existing conditions. We have to develop a regulating plan. We have to develop a vision and goals and objectives for that and try to figure out how the regulating plan is going to achieve those vision, goals, and objectives. From that, there would be the third step that we're talking about. There would be a site plan review process, but this could probably be more of an administrative process than it would be a public hearing process. And the reason for that is because all of that planning work has been done up ahead of time as part of the regulating plan, as part of developing the transect standards and understanding how those transect standards work with one another when you develop the regulating plan. So that's a planning process that comes up a little bit later. It would be, if we do that type of thing, we try to push the site plan review down to a staff level from doing the public hearing, it is a staff-driven process. It's not something that would involve a lot of public hearings. It's not something we'd go out and advertise and post the property for. Because those standards have already been met and someone comes through and proposes a project that complies with those standards, then it would be up to staff to make sure during the review process that it does that. But then we're talking about going straight to construction documents. So it tends to accelerate development once that regulating plan is in place from that standpoint. It can be.
Councilman Riches?
It would be labor-intensive up front, but then it's easier to regulate on the back end, right?
Right. Well, Mayor and Council, let's go back. And I know we didn't do it in the pure form, Gordon, when we did DMB. But that's similar in concept in the fact that we spent on the, now I always get my terminology wrong, John, help me out. We did the community plan and then we have the development units, correct? So I know that's not exact pure translation, but maybe kind of put that in the context of how they're
similar. Well, we started out with a general plan.
Right.
Which designated the area as a defined planning area.
Mm-hmm.
And gave us the leeway and the flexibility under the general plan designation,
correct,
the legal designation, to create a community plan, which then narrowed down to the specific development area, or what do they call those? The
DUs. But I was trying.
The
yes.
Development units.
What I was saying is, though, we spent a lot more time than we typically do on the front end, looking at a lot of other issues related to not just the form, but the quality and that's how we got into engineering standards on the front end, as opposed to dealing with those more on the site plan issue. Is that correct, John?
Correct, Mayor. That's. Has set a good example. Again, it's not quite a pure form of how we would use the form-based code, but we did spend a lot of time. We have not just use standards now for districts. We have a lot of the quality and how those different areas relate, and we have started talking about some of the engineering standards. Did all that up front. So as we move through the development units and on the site plans, it does become a much more staff-driven process.
Well, and I think the approach was very form-related oriented, because we looked at the overall community. And then we looked at the development units not as individual units, but as part of an overall of a whole community, and how they interacted and interrelated to each other.
Sure.
So you didn't go from one stark land use like the urban center into something that's completely different and was designed without any consideration as to the urban center that was taking place. There's a natural transition, but it's much more subtle than what you'd see in Euclidean, where all of a sudden you literally could have one land use and then another land use with maybe a little bit of a buffer. This takes into account that you will naturally transition between one general use and another general use.
Okay. Yeah, and you do that through form.
Through form.
So I wanted to go real quickly over, staff has been working with what we call a technical review committee. This is made up of two people from design review, two people from P&Z, and two people from the Downtown Development Committee. And they've been advising staff as we've been going through and looking at the zoning code update. One of their recommendations is that there's a new district that's being proposed as part of the zoning code update, something called a mixed-use district. We'd also be taking a look at something called transit mixed-use, which is a new district also, TMX, related to transit-oriented development, as well as taking a look at the town center districts. Their recommendation is that we make those districts form-based. So that there would be a transition for those. People would have to rezone to the MX and the TMX districts, but for the town center districts, there would be a conversion factor. A lot of those are already mixed-use districts, so it's just a matter of kind of switching the priorities a little bit. I don't think we're necessarily, we'll try to avoid 207 issues to the degree possible, but I think we'll be able to do that in the downtown area. In addition to that, there, in terms of some areas.
Well, isn't by its nature, and we're getting philosophical here, one thing I loved about your philosophical distinctions is, whereas a Euclidean, it's a proscriptive. It tells you what you can't do. Mm-hmm. Whereas an inform base, it tells you what you can do. In other words, it opens up possibilities. I mean, isn't that, I don't want a legal opinion, but by its nature, you would think that that would go well beyond any problems we have with 207, because we're actually expanding the possibilities for land use by going to form rather than a very, very restrictive type of a thing. And, you know, once again, we don't need to get into the legalese of it, but just, and as a general statement, it would seem like we're doing something that overall, I hope we're accomplishing that, because if we're not, then why are we doing this? And I think the purpose is to increase the use and to expand the both the viability and the economic value that exists in it. But I'll let Ms. Spinner and Ms. Donna talk about that.
No, Mayor, I think you're right. That is the goal. On an individual parcel, obviously,
yeah,
we'll have to wait and see, and it will be up to the landowner to decide with regard to their personal property.
But I really like the idea that this is encouraging people to go beyond what they might otherwise feel they're restricted in doing, and what the law, what our current code may actually restrict them from doing.
Sure.
They're going beyond and creating additional uses, which creates additional economic activity and value. I hope that's where we end up. I think
that's the goal. That's what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. So.
Okay. And then real quickly, just kind of. There have been four areas, at least, that I've been able to discern, where there's been specific discussion about possible adoption of form-based codes in those areas. One of those included the Fiesta District. That was part of some of the discussion that had to do with the adoption of the Fiesta District guidelines. We've talked about this along the transit corridors, particularly along the light rail and the bus rapid transit areas. We've talked about this. It's one of the actual specific goals that was outlined in the Gateway Strategic Plan. And we've also talked about it a little bit to the extent in the downtown area. Just wanted to make sure that that's the idea, but also to caution the council that if we do that in these particular areas, we can go through and we can incorporate these transect ideas, these standards, into the zoning code as part of the update process. But that doesn't apply it to specific areas. That has to be a separate process. And so, to a certain extent, it's almost like going through a sub-area plan process to figure out, to do the analysis, to study the area, and then to actually develop a regulating plan that applies these specific transects to the specific lots in those particular areas. So that would not be an expectation we would hope would be part of the zoning code update, but to understand that's going to take some separate planning that may take maybe even possibly hiring a consultant to actually do the sub-area work on that particular area.
All right, any questions? Thank you so much.
Sure.
This was very, very well done, and I appreciate all the work and all the thought you've put into that. As I go back to where we started today, which was with our strategic initiatives, I look at how this, both on some very specific items and on an overall basis, fits in very well with where I think this council wants to head, which is to create an environment that that encourages people to go beyond, that encourages investment, that encourages business activity, that encourages creativity. And I think the form-based code, for the reasons we've talked about, does just that. And I applaud your efforts. I know that it would have been easy just to go with the status quo. And you, specifically Gordon, and the staff and your staff have really reached out and gone beyond that. So thank you so very much for those efforts. Councilmember Summers.
Thank you, Gordon. It was a great presentation. On the form-based districts, you talk about Fiesta District. Just, I'd like you to keep in mind Superstition Springs Center is a possibility as well.
Sure.
As we move through on the Fiesta District, I know it's very early in that, but I think it would.
We just try to reflect what we've heard. If that's, again, if that's something the council wants to consider, we can certainly add that.
Talking about the Fiesta District, for example, I think we can see that, and it would really surprise me if 10, 15 years from now, we drove down Southern and still saw those strip centers there. I think they're going to evolve into a natural use, which would be much more urban in nature, would include probably some residential, some office, whatever makes sense. That fits right in with the form-based approach. And right now, we could honestly say you could not accomplish that because of the restrictions that existing zoning place on those properties. Obviously, the market does not support the existing land use because there's stores that are boarded up. There's entire centers that are boarded up. So I think that this is exactly what we need, not only as a land use item, but also as an economic development and a quality of life. I think it covers all three, but it's using our regulatory process to create that kind of condition and scenario where that can happen and that can flourish. So thank you very much. Vice Mayor.
And Gordon, I want to thank you and all those who have worked with you and John. This has been a long process, been going on for quite some time, not something that just happened overnight. And so it's been very time consuming. And kind of got put on the back burner when we were dealing out with the Gateway area, and then we get back on track. So, I want to thank all of those involved for working on this. It's a great accomplishment.
Thank you.
Okay. Next item on the agenda, hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Councilmember Summers.
Thank you, Mayor. In your absence, I attended the opening of Engle Hall, which is the Chandler Gilbert Community College campus on Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. Engle Hall will be used for training of nurses and specialty medical personnel, has state-of-the-art simulations, patient simulators that can be used. It's another phenomenal asset in the education of meets the the HEAT, which one is that? Education is in there, and healthcare both. So we hit two with one stone on this particular opening. If you have the opportunity, I recommend you go down there and take a look at that. Also, thank you to staff for another very successful pancake breakfast at Fire Station 205. I heard they were running out of pancakes. They had to move a little bit faster. Quite a few folks showed up, had their questions answered. ADOT was there on hand, as was RPTA, to talk about transportation issues and the new bus and light rail. So thank you to them as well.
Thank you. Councilmember Higgins?
To add to that event, we have a new city button that says the green is the new black. All right, so that's what we got to go for. Green is the new black, people. That's it. And I got that.
Wait, no explanation as to green being the new black?
Green. Yes. That means we're going to be green. We're going to be more conscientious about recycling. Instead of pink being the new black or orange, green is the new black. Little play. Come on.
No, I'm hearing it. I'm just listening to your explanation of it.
There was no explanation.
There was no explanation, but for you, I kind of broke it down a little bit. You're welcome.
Thank you. I'm slow.
I'm excited.
Yeah. Okay. Vice Mayor.
This past weekend, it was once again my privilege to represent the city down at our sister city in Guaymas, Mexico. We had a very nice trip. Also, yesterday was opening day of spring training, and the Cubs playing the Dodgers. There was a good turnout there, good way to kick off the season. And then last night, Mayor, I represented you on the MAG Regional Council. It was a very interesting meeting, to say the least, when you're talking about how to divvy up transportation money. So, I say, glad you're back home. You get to take your meetings back over.
Oh, Jay, thanks. And thank you for filling in for me. Anything else? And the reason why they had to fill in for me is I returned last night, Mr. Brady and a couple other staff, and I had the privilege of a quick trip to Washington, D.C. I have learned one thing. One thing I did learn from this is if Chris Brady tells you the restaurant we're walking to is just a couple, three blocks.
He's lying.
And it's 20 degrees with a 25-mile-an-hour wind, which makes the wind chill factor in single digits. Get a cab. Don't walk. it was cold. But we had some great meetings. We met with all of our congressional delegation. We had good meetings there. We met with the Department of Transportation, the FAA, on both transportation monies and specifically airport monies, which went very well. We met with the Department of Justice on things, and of course there was one issue that was brought up in every meeting and everybody you talked to back there. If you're not talking stimulus in Washington, you're not talking anything. Also met with the Conference of Mayors and put in our two bits on how it affects it, and also met with White House staff specifically to talk about stimulus monies and how it affects cities. Voiced our concerns about the process, and we had a very good back and forth as to the challenges they have in administering money. And as Vice Mayor found out last night, the realities of how that stimulus money flows down and what eventually is going to end up with the cities. And what we're finding out is that it will be an interesting process. And I don't think anyone really knows for sure exactly what the end result will be, other than, you know, it's in many ways it's confusing, but in other ways it's at least starting to come out. So is that all we met with? It was a busy 2 days, very busy 2 days. So once again, very beneficial. It's good for us to get back there. I mean, I know some people may say, gee, why do you go to Washington? Well, why do you meet with your congressional delegation? Primarily, you know, we meet with the Congressman Flake, Congressman Mitchell, the senators here in Arizona. But a lot of the work is done by their staffs in Washington. And when we talk about the importance of our airports, when we talk about what's going on, the people who do the work day in and day out are the legislatives, are the congressional staffs and people in the Department of Justice in Washington. And so if we're not there, at least getting good information, finding out, and basically letting them know that we're here, that work just won't get done. It's just not something you can do from back here. For example, in our meeting with the FAA, we learned some very important things about how to put forth funding requests for work to be done both at Falcon and Gateway, things that were brand new that we were not aware of, even our consultant was not aware of, because it's literally something that's just come up in the last few weeks, it sounds like. We also were reaffirmed by meeting with a group from the FAA that both Gateway and Falcon are very high on their list of priorities. It's nice to be talking to a top administrator in the FAA and realize that they not only are aware of Gateway but can tell you details about Gateway. And when you look at all the hundreds of airports throughout the country and find out that your airport is very much high on the list of priorities of the FAA and those who make decisions as far as where funding goes and to do things like build taxiways, which, as we've seen, has a direct economic benefit to us. For when the taxiways were completed to get to the north part of the airport, all of a sudden it became viable for Cessna and Hawker Beechcraft and Embraer to build their facilities. We forget that one of the great things about having an Air Force base is you get nice runways. Air Force bases generally do not have ways to get off the runways because their uses are very well defined. And they have a very specific way of operating, which is in many ways is conflicts with a civilian use. And so things like taxiways are extremely important
for the continued development. So what we're working on now out there, for example, is extending taxiways to the southern part, which is our primary heavy industrial and other use, and that's what we're back in Washington meeting on, is those things and understanding what would be available. Another thing that the FAA was very interested in was Allegiant. They were very much aware of their success. We gave them some information as to Allegiant's numbers and some of the surprising things, such as Allegiant is finding, for example, if you've noticed, let me back up, if you've noticed, Allegiant does not advertise in the Phoenix area. You don't see a whole lot of advertising here. The reason being is that their business plan was to advertise in outlying cold weather areas to bring people into the area in vacation packages because they are a leisure airline. And so they figured that about 80% of their flights would originate in places like Great Falls, Montana, Bellingham, Washington, coming into Phoenix, Mesa area, and that about 20% would originate here, and that would primarily be families who were going out there. What they found is that has not held true. They are drawing a much larger number, about more than twice as many people that they assumed would originate in the Phoenix Mesa area are actually starting here. So well over about 40% of their trips, and it's moving toward about half and half with no advertising, no real promotion. What that means is that indicates that Phoenix Mesa Gateway has the not only potential but is showing that it will fill a role as a true reliever airport, because there are people here that are using that as their primary place to leave from, which has been a pleasant surprise. And it's something that we're going to take as we go and talk to additional airlines, as we talk to the FAA. They are happy to see that the potential of Gateway, and we've talked a lot about that potential and whether that would actually ever come to pass. And now we're seeing data that indicates that truly is there. It's not any longer an idea. It's a reality that people are using it as an alternative, which really benefits both Sky Harbor and Gateway. It's a win. It truly is a win-win. So those were the most of our meetings. Mr. Brady, did I forget anything?
No, Mayor, I think you covered the meetings. You also talked a lot about the Aerospace Institute, which was new, and I think that was important to pass
along. That was
new,
yeah.
So it's always helpful to keep a good dialogue going. And as you said, these are administrators where we make applications that the applications were in their offices, or they are getting ready to put their applications on the Internet this week. And yeah. So it very much helps to have the conversation about what are they looking for in the applications. And right now, in the history, in our recent history of federal programs, there's more money out there and more times we're going to have to apply. And you know, we don't know how much we're going to get, but there's a lot of competitive grants out there that is important to understand what the expectations of the different agencies are. So
and once again, these are through normal programs that exist where there's a pool of money and we are literally competing with other airports. And these are not your earmarks or the things that are dirty words. These are the normal program things. And then in addition to that, certainly the stimulus. And there's, once again, there's still a lot of questions as to exactly how that's going to take place. So that was what I did on my summer vacation in 2 days, or winter vacation. And once again, take a taxi.
See, your lips are still frozen.
My lips are still frozen. Man, it was cold. Mr. Brady, schedule meetings.
We do have a General and Economic Development Committee meeting following this meeting today. And Councilmember Richens, do you want to talk a little bit about your event this weekend, this Saturday?
Sure. On Saturday, we're meeting in front of the Garden Center at Walmart at Riverview. We have about 650 confirmed volunteers, and we keep getting more people calling every day. Meet at the Garden Center at 7 o'clock. I know that there's 6 Boy Scout Eagle projects going on and several other projects. The city senior, I think it's the, is it the senior city staff has taken on one of the projects?
That would just be Jack.
Just Jack. Here we go, just Jack again. Jack has taken on a project himself. We're very proud of him. I'll give him a T-shirt.
This is Jack's Eagle project?
He felt bad about missing out on that as a kid, and so we're going to get him an award. So anyway, I appreciated all the support and all the volunteers, and we're looking forward to a great event. It's called Top to Bottom. It's kind of District 1 spring cleaning, if you will.
Thank you, Councilmember. And just a reminder, Council, our next council meeting, study session council meeting will be Monday, March 2nd. Thank you.
Councilmember Summers.
I can't one-up Dave, but I will mention, since you have 600 volunteers assembling in your district on Saturday, we'll have an additional 200 volunteers to begin the Building Strong Neighborhoods program for this year in District 6. It'll be Southern and Sossaman. So good. A lot of volunteerism going on this weekend.
Good. Okay, anything else? All right. We have one item on a pre-scheduled public opinion, Mr. Jim Gardner, Jr. Mr. Gardner?
Thank you. I don't know when the clock begins. It's kind of a misnomer what's scheduled on there, and the fact that it's not unlicensed contractors. It's the carpentry services contract, which I've held with the city for 14 years. This was designed to help the city implement projects that were needed on a fast and quick basis rather than going through engineering when it was a simple or moderately designed project. It's worked very well for 14 years. Over the last 14 years, or in this year alone, the city of Mesa has spent more money buying toilet paper. And I contend that the carpentry services contract has provided more security and more comfort than all the toilet paper you purchased last year. The reason for that is an example. Dobson Library needed some electronic devices so they could tell whether a book was being taken out without being checked out. They spent thousands of dollars hiring an architect and engineers to determine how to put in two 110 outlets. They contacted us after they'd spent all this money and said, what can you do? We looked at it, and you can see this picture. Is it showing up on the... The Dobson Library has conduits running all over. The engineers from the city had decided to cut the floor and run conduits in the floor and give them two 110 outlets. When we interviewed the project, we decided, you've got all these conduits in the attic, why don't we just add one more and make this a simple project? And we completed the project for less than, well, for $3,400, where the architecture fees were much more than that. This has happened repeatedly every year. For example, there's this structure here that was a camel. They needed an emergency access from the basement of the municipal building. Engineering came in, designed it, they built it. You see a flaw there? It's a funnel that takes all the rainwater down in the basement, and every time it rained, the basement was flooded in the municipal building. We were then called in to determine how to best overcome that. It took thousands of dollars to chisel out the concrete in the basement, to redirect it to a sump pump. This happens constantly, and that's the reason for my contract, is to simplify and use the 10 years of experience that's required for this contract to save the city money. They've contacted us and with the Mesa Arts Center. The elevator's collapsed. Our contract has no dollar limits. We've asked repeatedly for somebody in purchasing to write down on a slip of paper the parameters of my contract, dollar-wise, and what it's allowed to perform. They've repeatedly not done that because it's confusing, and the individual departments are confused. The elevators, both sections, the west and the central elevators, collapse because of faulty piping in the hydraulic system. It took them 2 months to agree to let me do it for the contract price that I had submitted. That's a safety hazard. That's a problem the city has, and they've got a contract in place that can take care of that, but they're ignoring it because facilities maintenance has it in their heads that my contract is limited to $2,500. And it is not. Another example is where they hired the engineering department to take care of grinders. Now, for you that don't know what grinders are, they add an extension to their axle, and they grind to see how far they can go on a planter. The city engineering department determined they would cut notches in the planter. Very good. But the axles extend beyond their cuts, so the grinders were still able to destroy all the planters within the city of Mesa. We were called in to design something that would overcome that. We did it in a matter of days, installed it in a matter of days, and the grinders put on an internet death threats for contractors that make these solutions. It's the reason for the contract. Why don't they use it? Because they're limited in their minds to $2,500. This is an example. The city of Mesa has a painting contract. It's $28.50 an hour. The painter puts on one hat, paints for $28.50 an hour. He puts on another hat and goes across the street and paints for $48.64 an hour. Explain it to me. In the last 6 months, they have overspent $116,000 on that contract, and that's what brought this to my attention. Every time my contract has been renewed, and it's been renewed four times with five extensions, that contract has said, you're allowed to ask any questions. Just recently, I asked a question. They came back with an answer in 10 days that my contract was no longer good, it was not serving the city in the manner that it should be, and it should be rewritten and submitted for bids. I contend that I renewed my contract with the city of Mesa under their direction by the October 30th of last year, that purchasing said it had been committed, that it was being renewed. The only thing that hadn't been done was the formal documentation. That formal documentation has never been done within the time limits. In 06, when the contract was renewed, it took Ed Quinnen's 38 days after the contract became empowered to sign the final arrangements. It's probably only 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner. Thank you very much. Since this is on the agenda, Mr. Gardner has met with us, has met with members of the council, and has met with me. There are other things that we have discussed, and we have directed the city auditor and the city attorney are looking into various things that you brought up today to ensure that the city is doing things in a
May I ask one more question?
You may ask another question.
My contract is only limited to $25,000. When we met with the deputy city manager, mm-hmm. he said that we might complete any project that had been initiated prior to the expiration of the contract. We did that in good faith with the fire department and with the Mesa Arts Center. We have the drawings completed. We have the estimates completed from different cabinet manufacturers. Everything is in order. But while you and I met, the deputy city manager squashed that and said that could no longer be done. I don't understand it. I applaud your decision to make open and fair and
We'll certainly look into that, and that'll be part of it. Because, like I said, you and I have gone over these things and talked about it. We take this stuff seriously, and so we're talking. And once again, I met with the city auditor, and we'll follow up on to make sure that what's being done is in the best interest of the city. And we'll.
I did want to pass the cup around so everybody could contribute to money to help buy this poor painter some ladders. Because he's charged us over $5,000 for ladders in the last 6 months and ladders and equipment, and the poor guy needs help. If anybody here could contribute, I'd be willing to pass it around.
I would, but I'm in home building. You know what that industry's in right now. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. We appreciate that. Okay, Ms. Crocker, any other requests to speak from citizens' presence?
No additional requests, Mayor.
Okay. We'll then accept a motion to convene an executive session.
So moved. Second.
Motion by Councilmember Summers, second by the Vice Mayor. All in favor?
Aye.
We'll move into executive session. Thank you very much.